On the program today, how worried ought the big banks be? Also, scooters and car repair. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, today, 15 July. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Bank earnings continue today. Goldman Sachs did quite nicely, thanks. PNC Financial Services and U.S. Bank Corp reported as well. Also quite tidy profits. But there, the apparent similarities end, because PNC and U.S. Bank Corp do a whole lot more consumer business than Goldman does. And they both reported setting aside more money, a lot more money, actually, to handle loans that might go bad. We've been telling you about the past couple of days that that's the story on Wall Street right now. Now, why are banks so worried about whether consumers are going to pay them back? Well, because we're in the middle of a pandemic and a recession, right? So maybe a better setup is exactly how big should their worry be? As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, big.
At the end of the first quarter of this year, U.S. consumers were a record $14.3 trillion in debt.
There's a lot of debt out there.
Rita McGrath is a professor at Columbia Business School. She points out that $14 trillion in consumer debt, that was before the pandemic hit.
This is a kind of a time bomb that's been coming for a long time.
Now, massive layoffs have left some consumers wondering how they're going to pay the bills. Ian O'Neill lost his job as a technician on the New York set of the CBS series FBI back in March. They were 2 days away from wrapping up episode 19.
And they decided that not only were we not going to finish episode 19, we weren't going to finish the remaining four episodes for the season. And that was it.
O'Neill is the breadwinner for his wife and two kids. They have a balance of about $20,000 on their Discover card, plus a car lease payment, student loan, and a mortgage. O'Neill says so far he's been able to freeze all those payments. They're getting by on his unemployment check. That includes an extra $600 a week, which runs out at the end of this month.
So when those programs start to run out, that's when I get really panicked about what am I supposed to do?
O'Neill says his first priorities will be the mortgage, utilities, and food. The credit card debt, that comes last. Banks know that. G. Scott Clemens, chief investment strategist at Brown Brothers Harriman, says three of the biggest consumer banks have set aside billions in the second quarter to cover loans they might have to write off.
But $30 billion of loan loss reserves for a single quarter tells you that they're anticipating a lot worse to come.
Clemens says crunch time could come as soon as this September, especially if unemployed people don't find new jobs or get any more help from the federal government. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
It's none of my business, I know, but how many streaming services are you willing to pay for? I'm asking because NBC's new platform, Peacock, it is cleverly called, launched today into a desperately crowded field. But as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports, this one might be a bit of a game changer.
Netflix, HBO Max, Disney Plus. Tim Hanlon with the Vertir Investment Advisor Group says when it comes to streaming platforms,
there is an endpoint to consumers' ability to pay for so many subscription streaming services.
NBC's new streaming service, Peacock, launched today, might signal that endpoint. It has several paid tiers and an option to watch for free. Well, kind of. The free tier has advertisements. Remember those? Streaming with advertising isn't entirely new. It's already done by platforms like Tubi, Pluto TV, Roku Channel. But NBC has a lot more popular original content, like everyone's secret favorite, Law & Order SVU, and The Office, coming to Peacock next year, plus live news shows and sports. Still, the question remains, after years of ad-free streaming services, will people put up with commercials again? Experts say we already do. We put up with constant ads on social media. Also, we're in the middle of a severe economic crisis, so if it means spending less money to take a bathroom break during commercials, a lot of people will be okay with that. As long as it's not too many commercials. Professor Arun Sharma at the University of Miami says companies are very aware there's a limit.
Most companies will tell you we won't do more than 90-second advertising in any blog. They are trying to control the amount of advertising.
Some are wondering if this will usher in a new era of ad-supported streaming. HBO Max, which is now $15 a month, has said it will launch a cheaper ad-supported tier early next year. Analyst Neil Macker with Morningstar says he thinks video streaming is going to start looking a lot more like music streaming. Consider Spotify.
They still have a ton of users on the ad-supported side of that, the free tier.
Some people will go for the free option. Others will pay for no commercials. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Couple of corporate notes on this Wednesday. Number one, it looks like our appetite for, you know, fine-ish Mexican food, fast cash version, is pretty strong. Chipotle said today it's going to wind up hiring 10,000 people to handle its booming digital and drive-through businesses in this pandemic. It's already hired 8,000 of them since it started in May. Also, and number two, Walmart, the company said today that starting on Monday, masks are going to be required in all of its stores. And related, the National Retail Federation said it is calling on all of its members to do the same. Here's the quote from the press release. Retailers are protecting the health and safety of communities they serve. Our elected leaders need to set politics aside and follow their example, end of quote. That right there is basically a corporate lobbying group calling for regulation. The calls on Wall Street today were to buy on use of yet another positive vaccine trial. We will have the details when we do the numbers. The reality of this pandemic is that it's disproportionately affecting and killing people of color. That is reality number one, actually. Reality number two is that structural inequality and systemic economic racism have been a kind of pandemic of their own for centuries now. So Minnesota, as have more than 60 other states and local governments, is moving to declare racism a public health crisis. Now, is that actually going to change anything? We asked Marketplace's Kristen Schwab to find out.
Milwaukee County was the first to pass a resolution declaring racism a public health crisis in May 2019. The move wasn't inspired by a big event, but study after study showing economic inequality in the county was among the worst in the country.
A part of the work is to name and acknowledge that those things are true and that people in power believe that it's true.
Paula Tran Inzio is with the University of Wisconsin's Public Health Institute. The institute works with nearly 100 local organizations, including hospitals, research groups, and schools, to set goals for diversity in hiring or measuring outcomes for things like infant mortality. Kamara Phyllis-Jones, an epidemiologist at Morehouse College, says declaring a crisis invites accountability.
And 6 months from now, the public can say, so County X or City Y, what are you doing? What have you done? And what are you going to do about this?
Most of the counties and states that have declared this a crisis just did it in the last few months. But actually measuring progress is complicated, and funding doesn't always follow, says Thomas Leviste, who teaches health equality at Tulane University.
The public health emergency here, racism, is quite amorphous because racism is at the foundation of much of what we do in this society.
Housing, education, jobs, healthcare.
It's not like an acute traumatic event like a hurricane or earthquake that we know has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
And unlike a national disaster, a racism crisis doesn't trigger a flood of government funds. So until a national entity creates rules, states and cities will make them up as they go. I'm Kristen Schwab from Marketplace.
Electric vehicles, I will tell you what, are having a moment. Nissan rolled out an all-electric SUV today. Tesla, I mean, have you seen its share price up 30% in just July? And billions of dollars have been poured into electric van and truck makers that have yet to produce a single vehicle. And yet, might we remind you, we are in a recession, car sales are down, and gas is cheap. Marketplace's Scott Tong has more on the EV mania.
To beat out gasoline cars, electric vehicles have to be better or equal when it comes to driving range, access to energy, total cost of ownership. And a lot of investors think that day is coming soon.
I see the tipping point starting in 2025.
Seth Goldstein chairs the Electric Vehicle Committee at Morningstar. He thinks half the vehicles sold in 2030 will be electric or hybrid. Already, battery technology is mature.
Most electric vehicles can go 300 miles or greater on a single charge, and that is the number where consumers would say, okay, now I would consider an electric vehicle.
Lately, investors have poured some $2 billion into electric SUV brands Fisker and NIO. And e-trucks are the rage, too. Nikola Motor and Rivian will make plug-in pickups, and Bren Workhorse an electric van. Many are preparing for the cities of tomorrow, which will increasingly mandate clean vehicles, predicts Riley Brennan at the venture capital firm Trux.
Lyft recently announced that by 2030, all of their vehicles are going to be zero emission. We can imagine in the next 9 or so years that commercial fleets are going to have to think the same way, a UPS truck, an Amazon truck.
Still, it seems an odd moment for EV exuberance. We're in the middle of a recession and driving's down. But Evangelos Simoutis at the venture firm Synapse Partners says investors are enthusiastic long-term, perhaps too enthusiastic.
It happens in every other aspect of technology investing. There is an overheating.
Many of today's four-wheeled unicorns have yet to produce a single vehicle, and he warns a lot can go wrong on the factory floor. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Coming up.
And we're ready to start March 1st.
Cue the pandemic, of course. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on this Wednesday. The Dow Industrial's up 227, 0.8%, finished at 26,870. The NASDAQ lifted 61 points, about 0.5%, 10,550. The S&P 500 climbed 29, 0.9%, 32.26 there. It is tax day today, lest you had forgotten. So as we look at our personal economies a little bit, some figures on taxes crunched by WalletHub. This year, the average amount filers spent completing and filling out a 1040 tax form, yes, completing and filling out are the same thing, about $210. Average tax refund as of June 5, running about $2,700 so far. Bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose. 0.63% is the yield. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The shared mobility movement. You know what I'm talking about, right? You have seen the bikes. You have almost surely been run over by the scooters a time or two. That is the shared mobility movement. And it took a hit while people weren't really leaving their houses much and definitely not going into the office. Lime, one of the big bike and scooter companies, is out with a report today on how people have been getting around since the outbreak started. Wayne Ting is the CEO of that company. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
So you guys have some visibility into sort of real-time economic data, which is why we wanted to get you on the phone, because you know when people are using the scooters and the bikes and you know when they stopped. And where I want to start is what it looked like at the beginning of this thing when people, I would imagine, stopped in those urban areas near offices using your products. What'd you see?
Yeah, so at the beginning of COVID, what we saw was people stopped leaving their homes. And we saw a pretty dramatic decrease in trips overall. And we saw a complete going away of tourism. Historically, folks who are not from the city, it's about 30% of our trips. And that completely went away at the beginning of COVID.
Huh. When did you see things start to pick back up in a meaningful way?
You know, around early May, some of the cities were exiting shelter in place. We saw was first going to local shops and restaurants and grocery stores, and a lot of interesting trends around longer trips, and more new use cases that we didn't historically see on micromobility.
Well, yeah, I want to talk about a couple of those because they're completely fascinating in a new report you guys have out. But one of the things that caught me, there's a series of maps in this report, and what you all are seeing, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is less traffic in dense urban cores and more spread out toward and approaching suburbs, right?
Absolutely. You know, pre-COVID, a lot of our trips were in downtown financial districts. You know, of course, folks are oftentimes using scooters as a first mile, last mile complement to public transit. But what we've seen instead is a really dramatic surge in longer trips in residential neighborhoods. We think because they're taking it end to end. So it's no longer a first mile, last mile complement. What they're doing is they're taking it from their home all the way to the grocery stores.
When you say longer, you mean longer distance and longer time too, right?
Yeah. So we're seeing about a third longer distance and time. And people take micromobility for joyrides. We see people start at their home, they go on a 30 or 40 minute trip, and they end up in the same location. And what we think is happening is people want to be outdoors, and they're not quite sure how to be outdoors while observing social distancing, but they want to get the sun, they want to get the air, and they find bikes and scooters a really good way to do that.
What happens? I mean, look, we don't know what the future of work is going to look like, right? But what happens if we don't, on a large scale or even a medium scale, go back to office life as we knew it? What's that going to mean for Lyme?
You know, we already see some of this shift, but in many of these places, it's being overwhelmed by a huge surge in trips, running errands, joyriding, visiting friends. In fact, one of the things that's most interesting when we're looking at our data is that many of them are the places hardest hit by COVID. So Korea, Italy, we're hitting all-time record trips. When we talk to our riders, what we're hearing is that they're much more conscious about finding something that is safe, that is social distancing. And when they leave their homes to do a variety of things, even if it's not going to work, you know, we certainly know that many people are looking at Lyme and many more people are going to in the future.
Last question, and then I'll let you go in, and it's about the company itself. You are the third CEO Lyme has had in the 3 years it's been around. We are in the middle of a big economic downturn for all the success that your company seems to be having. How are you going to pull this company through? Are you just going to keep on keeping on?
Yeah, you know, I definitely, you know, I'm the third CEO in a very relatively young company, and I take that responsibility very seriously. You know, I do think we actually were originally expecting to be profitable this year. COVID has pushed that back. We're now expecting to be profitable for the year 2021. And hopefully, if we do all those things, Lyme will be around for a long time, and hopefully I'll be a CEO for a little bit longer.
Wayne Ting is the CEO of Lyme. Wayne, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Kai.
A milestone of sorts in the vacation industry in this coronavirus economy. Airbnb said this month that for the first time since stay-at-home orders started being a thing back in March, people have booked a million nights of accommodation in a single day. The company has had, of course, a rough year, pandemic-induced losses. It laid off nearly 2,000 people not so long ago. So, too soon to talk turnaround? Marketplace's Erica Barris has that one.
Spring is usually pretty busy for Charles Chapman's rental house on the Lake Erie shore in Ashtabula, Ohio. But not this year. In March, Airbnb bookings dried up completely. Then in June,
we went back to being like 100% booked for the summer.
More of his visitors than usual are coming from nearby, from the Cleveland and Pittsburgh areas.
I'm not having anybody really coming from far, which usually I'll get a couple people.
Airbnb says what Charles Chapman is seeing is pretty typical right now. Recent bookings tend to be in remote areas, and guests tend to come from within a couple hundred miles. Hospitality analyst Andrea Stokes with J.D. Power says surveys have found that travelers are
way more comfortable taking road trips over flying somewhere. And then trips closer to home were, you know, going to be a little more popular than longer drive trips.
By avoiding hotels, it's easier to steer clear of potential infection. Crystal Watson, who works on pandemic preparedness at Johns Hopkins, says it's actually healthy to want to hit the road and see new things.
We've all been under this social distancing regime for the last several months, and I know everyone is tired of it.
Bookings at remote locations are a boon to those hosts, but they may not do much for the company, says Dan Thomas, an analyst with Third Bridge.
It's large cities that are driving a lot of the traffic on the platform and a lot of the bookings on the platform.
And it's large cities where Airbnb makes most of its money. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Timing is everything. Everything. Exhibit A, this story right here.
My name is Aaron Gomes. I'm the owner of an automotive repair shop in the Bay Area in Mountain View. Prior to opening the shop, I was a stay-at-home mom for a brief time, I'd say about 2 months. My husband was working at the BMW dealership. We were budgeting, you know, with one income, and we decided that we wanted to pursue opening our own shop. We signed everything. We became incorporated in early February. We wanted to hit the ground running and just get going. I got a bunch of stuff for my daughter. I set up a little like daycare with a crib and sound machine and in my little office up in Mountain View. And we were ready to start March 1st. We knew COVID was there, but we did not know the extent of it. And 2 weeks later, I was watching on the news in the shop, the governor telling us that now there's a shelter in place. We looked up online, like, oh my gosh, are we essential? And we found that we are essential. So we knew that we could stay open. But then at the same time, my son's school shut down. So now I have to have my son there. And we were also worried about, you know, possibly getting sick or getting anybody else sick. We put everything into this, everything. And not just money, but our, you know, all of our energy. My husband left a job that he was at for 12 years. We basically put everything on the line. So I felt extremely scared. I thought at first, you know, we thought, what if we go bankrupt? Okay, then we're going to have to go get jobs, you know, but that's not an option for us. So we're, you know, working day and night. I did not get any of the loans. I did get the, I think it's EIDL advance. You get a certain amount per employee, and that was just a grant. So that, as far as my understanding, does not have to be paid back. The loan to where it will help me pay rent and pay my employees and medical insurance for them and us, that, you know, the much larger loan where I do have to pay it back, they won't even give me that. We, at this point, just want to keep open, keep being able to help customers fix cars. That's our thing. And hopefully in the future, we want to do well enough to where we can hire more people, create more jobs. We know if we make it through this, we will make it through anything. Once this is done, we are so excited to see what we can be like when it's back to normal.
Oh, we all are. That was Erin Gomes. She owns Bavarium Auto Works up in Mountain View, California, in San Francisco Bay Area. Tell us what's going on, would you? In your economy, you can do that at marketplace.org. We'll put it on the radio. This final note on the way out today, it is Beige Book Day, the Federal Reserve's 8 times a year anecdotal look at the state of the American economy. Generally good, the Fed says, allowing for deterioration since the virus began spiking. The thing about this book is there's usually a bunch of offbeat stories about this industry or that, kind of quirky sometimes how things are going. Here is really the thing you need to know. The only thing you need to know about today's report is from the New York Fed's report, which said, and this is a quote, most pandemic-related layoffs are still considered to be temporary, although one employment agency in upstate New York noted that some previously furloughed workers have more recently been laid off permanently. That right there is the next shoe to drop in this whole thing, gang, those permanent layoffs. All right, we are out of here. We will leave you, though, with this moment of economic context. It's from the Association of American Railroads, their weekly report on rail traffic. The week ended July 11, down almost 15% total traffic from the same period a year ago, which, while bad, seems somehow not terrible. Our media production team, again, the folks going into the studio so the rest of us don't have to, is Robin Edgar, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, Ben Tolliday, and Becca Weinman. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.